This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. This is Dr. Jonathan Abel. I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And today we're going to talk with Dr. Jeff Babb, our resident China expert. Dr. Babb, welcome.
Good to be here. Good to talk to the folks again about another Asian topic.
Yeah, we don't have enough of that. So today we're going to talk about an important aspect of World War II that a lot of people may not know much about, and that's the broadly the American experience in China, but more specifically General Joseph Stilwell. So let's start kind of in the very broadest sense. First of all, what is America's relationship with China kind of in the lead up to World War II, maybe a couple decades before?
Well, we are part of China's 100 years of humiliation. We are physically in Guangzhou or Canton, China, with an outpost right beside the Brits selling opium and ginseng and whatever. So but by early 1900, we try to make the rest of our friends and allies in the region have something called an open door policy. So that no one nation will colonize China. Now, the Japanese are going to try, but everybody else, the Japanese will go to war with the Chinese in 1895, and they will, in the Sino-Japanese War of 1895, at the end of that, at the Treaty of Shimonoseki, they will actually get Taiwan, which they'll keep for the next 50 years.
And more or less, they're headed towards a free hand in Korea, too. Am I remembering that right?
At the same time. The Sino-Japanese War starts in Korea over Japan and China vying for what would now probably be called hegemony, sovereignty. It's not exactly sovereignty. The Chinese tribute system is a way for them to deal with the nations on their periphery, and here they're buying with the Chinese over Korea. So it starts in Korea, but in the end, it gives them Taiwan. So the United States basically is one of the powers that occupies China and makes friends with China. Now, for Stilwell, he will start with a visit from the Philippines in 1911. Mm-hmm. And then during the 20s, he will be there for almost 4 years studying Chinese language. Today, the Army calls those folks foreign area officers. So he is essentially in the first group of China foreign area officers, learning the language, living in country, and studying the culture.
So how does the United States handle China in a time of transition, right? The last imperial dynasty's collapsing. There doesn't really seem to be a coherent central government that's emerging. Of course, we're eventually headed for communist rule decades later. So what are people like Stilwell doing there besides learning the language?
That's a great question. We have a regiment permanently assigned to China, the 15th Infantry Regiment. Now, the United States will be the fourth largest contingent in the Boxer Rebellion. In the Boxer Rebellion, the two main contingents will be the Russians and the Japanese. Mm-hmm. But the Brits, the Americans, the French will all have contingents. So our contingent, under a guy named Adnan Chaffee, is about 2,000 people. And from 1900 till 1941, the United States Army has a permanent presence in China. The Marine Corps has a permanent presence in China. And the United States Navy has actually been in China since 1854, when they began to patrol the internal rivers of China, off of the Yangtze River. It's called the Yangtze River Patrol, Yangpat. So we are there to protect our merchants, our missionaries, and have skin in the game in the diplomatic to and fro of dealing with China. So China, unlike India, never becomes a colony. But within China, there are the concessions where the foreign powers will set up shop. And for all intents and purposes, aside from servants and a few others, there'll be no Chinese that are allowed inside these concessions. We never officially have a concession. Mm-hmm. But we're there.
And if I remember correctly, the open door policy was about kind of breaking down the ossified nature of those concessions, right? Opening them up to more free trade.
The whole thing is about free trade. And that you have to back up before the 100 years of humiliation. About 40 years before 1839, it's called the McCartney Mission in 1793. When the Brits go in, an attempt to meet with the emperor, mm-hmm. and basically ask him to please open up China for diplomatic delegations and for treaty ports, treaty ports is a bad term, that for ports through treaty that can be open to international trade. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the emperor just says no. And so the die is cast for war with China, arguably in 1793, when they refuse to open to international trade. And it will be opened.
And this is back when the Qing Dynasty is still relatively strong, right?
The turning point of when the Qing Dynasty becomes weak is probably 1839. In the 1700s to 1790s, it's a pretty strong a dynasty. Mm-hmm. They move west, and they secure their borders, and the Qing is powerful, mm-hmm. until the mid 1800s.
Yeah, so we've got this kind of dynamic situation in China. We've got America protecting, as you mentioned, religious and trade interests.
Yep.
I'm going to pull on your experience here because you are a retired foreign area officer in the U.S. Army. So what's it like for an officer like Stilwell to be somebody cognizant of culture and language, to be in this country with essentially a very small brigade worth of troops, and to be watching all this happen around them? What's it like for somebody like him?
The interesting thing is that regiment, the 15th Infantry Regiment that's there, works more for the Department of State than the Department of Army. So it is a precursor to where he's going to be in 1937, where he is the full colonel in charge of the defense attaché office in Nanjing. I think, you know, like military officers today, it's not about the politics. It's about American interests. And if there's one thing you can say about Stilwell is he is an American. Mm-hmm. And so he hates the Brits, hates virtually anybody that's not an American. Will have a terrible relationship with Chiang Kai-shek, which, again, when Chiang Kai-shek comes to power in 1924 when he forms Whampoa, Sun Yat-sen dies, and he really picks up the mantle. Now, in 1927, he will conduct the Long March and will conduct the Shanghai Massacre to get rid of the communists. Stilwell is watching this. He's aware of it, but we're always looking for American interests. Mm-hmm. Now, the United States Navy has already decided that Japan's going to be the enemy. Mm-hmm. So, and Stilwell has served in the Philippines as well as in China. So he understands there's a colony to protect, the Philippines, and then there's this huge business enterprise called China, mm-hmm. That's in chaos. There's not much you can say from 1911 until 1949 except chaos and war. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great place for a soldier.
Mm-hmm. So let's kind of take this into the individuals as we go through there. So we didn't talk about, we've got the 15th Infantry Regiment there. We've got other folks present. Now, know that the 15th Infantry Regiment was often seen as a place where we kind of put the up-and-comers. But is there a thought process in the U.S. Army or perhaps the U.S. Navy where we're putting people in China who are China experts and we kind of make them such where we keep the, where we kind of send you there and we keep you there so that you can get good at it? Or is this just seen as a rotational tour? How does the Army view this?
It's interesting because Wedemeyer, who will replace Stilwell when he's relieved in 44, was in the 15th Regiment and was offered the opportunity to be a foreign area officer and basically said, no, there's no future in it. The United States Army is still an army for the line officers. And anybody that's out of the main track is out of the main track. Now, what's interesting about Stilwell is Stilwell serves with Marshall, who also serves in the 15th. Bradley and Marshall and he serve together at the infantry school. And so even though he is on a different track, he manages to dual track and kind of, it was easy to see why Wedemeyer thought, when Wedemeyer is known as the great strategist, where Stilwell is known as the great tactical soldier.
So you're kind of highlighting that Stilwell starts off as a tactical guy, then moves over and becomes a China expert, but does so at risk of his career, but is able to maintain that due to relationships with other folks.
And that's a great way to say it, because he was well known in the Army community. He could do both. He could move from one to the other. And, you know, unlike today where, you know, everybody's moving 2 years and everybody's having to check the blocks, there was an awful lot more time here in order to do things. I mean, he's in China, and, you know, instead of being in the CCC, you know, building buildings in the West or something. So it was a lot more open. There was a lot more opportunities to dual track.
So a typical officer that might serve with the 15th Regiment is there for 2 to 5 years or so. How long is Stilwell in China?
Altogether, the way I put it together, 20 to 23.
So 3 years.
3 years. I think 36 to 39.
3 more years.
And then 42 to 45. He gets relieved in 44, but he'll actually take over 10th Army when Buckner is killed in Okinawa, and he will actually be at the ceremony on the USS Missouri. So essentially, as is Barbara Tuchman's book, Stilwell and the American Experience in China, she says 1911 to 1945. Obviously, that was not continuous. It's back and forth. Aside from that time at the infantry school as an instructor, he also was an instructor at West Point. And he also served in World War I and was awarded a Distinguished Service Medal for one of the planners at the San Miguel Offensive. So he is doing other important things for the Army.
Okay, so but overall, we figured quick math, about 9 years in Asia for one officer, which is pretty impressive. Yep. Over amount of time.
Let me ask you a question, Dr. Nance, before we go any further. You know a lot about the officers who fight in World War II, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is his career, accepting that he is a FAO for a lot of it in modern terms, how is his career similar to some of the names people might be familiar with from that war, from a Bradley, a Marshall, somebody like that?
I mean, he kind of touches the right touch points, right? He is an instructor at one of the PME institutions. although West Point doesn't quite fit in that category, we'll just he has instructor duty. He is in World War One, which actually Eisenhower does not. Eisenhower commands a tank training school in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, right?
Right.
But he has the World War One experience, so he kind of has the right touch points. But what you see is kind of after World War One, the Army kind of has Pacific hands and people that maybe may have dabbled in there but are now doing other things. And so you have the people that are kind of more continental United States based, CONUS, and looking towards Europe, and you have the people that are more out in the Pacific. If you look at MacArthur, right? MacArthur did all the right things, but where was his focus after, particularly after he stopped being the chief of staff? It's out towards Asia.
He also retires, too. So he's
right, and ends up, well, retires. You have to put the air quotes there because somehow the Army still kind of keeps a line on him, right?
Right.
But so Stilwell is not an unusual officer in kind of the things, but he definitely starts to kind of specialize more than, say, a Bradley or an Eisenhower or a Patton, or he specializes differently than they do.
Yeah. So, Dr. Babb, back to you. Who is Joseph Stilwell? What's his background? What's his personality like? What is it like to be around him?
It's good to be on Vinegar Joe's good side. Let's put it that way. He picks up the title of Vinegar Joe as an instructor at Fort Benning. Irascible, mm-hmm. Demanding. Mm-hmm. But if you meet his demands... And there's an officer by the name of Dorn, who is his almost executive officer for many years, who's quite a Frank Dorn is basically one of his majors when he's a defense attaché and then stays with him. If you're loyal to him, he is loyal, and he's loyal to you as long as you are competent.
Mm-hmm.
But don't be incompetent and disloyal around Stilwell. It will not go well. And he's, I would argue he's, again, he may have developed into more of a strategist had he gone to another theater. He was supposed to be the commander in North Africa. Let me just look quickly at the note. He wasn't supposed to be the guy in China. Mm-hmm. The guy in China was a guy named Yu Drum, mm-hmm. who was a very senior officer. And I think Marshall understood whoever they send to China needs to be very senior. So the first choice was Yu Drum, who was like one of the most senior officers in the United States Army.
He was an area commander at the point. I use the term area commander because, or area army commander, because we had armies, today we might call them theater armies or field armies. They're different things now. But he was a training army commander, one of the top five or six guys in the Army at that level.
And I think Marshall understood, you need to send somebody to China that has the prestige. Yu Drum, the story goes, asked, well, how many forces will I command? And when the answer was none, he said, then find somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so Marshall knew Stilwell, his reputation as a China guy had preceded him. From 1939 to 1942, he commanded a brigade, a division, and a corps. So he's got all this China stuff in his background from that time in China when he was the attaché. He's a colonel.
Mm-hmm.
So what the United States Army sends to Chiang Kai-shek to be his chief of staff is not one of the top and senior American generals. They send him to a guy that just made brigadier.
Mm-hmm.
And Chiang Kai-shek knew him as a colonel. So now there's a colonel that's going to be the chief of staff in a huge army commanded by the Generalissimo,
mm-hmm.
there, that was not a very good way to start.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Chiang Kai-shek, you know, the relationship between Chiang Kai-shek and Stilwell is just absolutely terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And Stilwell in his Stilwell papers, it's just full of invective about Peanut. But at the end of the day, you could also see where Chiang Kai-shek, the generalissimo, who basically had been commanding an army taking China back when Stilwell is barely a captain in the army. This is not going to go over well. However, Stilwell had the language, the knowledge, the political background. But one of the other things that, while Stilwell is the attaché, he is watching the first year, or the first part of the first year, of what's called the Second Sino-Japanese War. Because the Second World War really begins not in Poland, but actually begins in China in July of 37. So from July of 37 on to the loss of Shanghai, Stilwell is watching the Chinese army do very badly. And some of that has to be blamed on Chiang Kai-shek and the way that he lined it up. General Lissow considers himself a great strategist, but I think when you look at the whole campaign in 37-38, it is a fighting retreat. Now, the new scholarship on that, Forgotten Ally by Ron Emitter, for one, basically says what you're actually seeing is a much better fight that did much more damage to the Japanese. Because what the story that was told, essentially the line was, once the United States joined the war, Chiang Kai-shek saved all his forces to fight the communists. That's just flat not fact anymore. The what's now opened up in the fights, especially there were four battles around the city of Changsha. First three, the Chinese won and inflicted great damage on the Japanese. Now, in the new Makers of Modern Strategy, Sally Payne, who it's S.C.M. Payne, who teaches up at the Navy War College, she makes the newest argument, the 2023 arguments, that that if we had not wasted our time trying to open up a line of communication across Burma, but had used our air and the divisions that we were going to train and equip against the Japanese in the mainland in southwest China, it might have gone a lot better.
Now, was Stilwell the one advising to do the open up the land route?
That's his baby. His baby is Chiang Kai-shek, give me the forces to open up the land route. Now, we can go back to the Cairo Conference of 1943, November of 43. Roosevelt tells Chiang Kai-shek, I will build you 90 divisions. We will train, equip, and advise 90 divisions. Now, you got to look out that this is a war that's going to go on until 49. The key to that was opening up a road. You can't fly this stuff over the hump.
Right.
You can't make 90 divisions flying stuff over the hump. You have to have a land route. And so this is where I think the historiography in the next 10 years will have to go back a little bit the other way. Because it basically says we didn't really need to open up the road. Well, the Chinese forces were not going to be able to fight the Japanese forces unless they had a great deal of American equipment. And the Chinese were originally part of Lend-Lease, but most of it goes to Russia and Britain. Only about 4% of Lend-Lease will go to China. Because part of it is there's no road.
Yeah. There's stuff that you're not putting on an airplane. Heavy artillery pieces, tanks, big trucks.
This is true even today, much less than 1944.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the kind of the details of all of this, so we understand the complexity of it. When Americans think of World War II, we tend to think, of course, of Europe, right? But when we think of Asia, we're really thinking of the Pacific. And people who maybe have a deeper understanding are also thinking of India. So we've got the two kind of maritime theaters. You've got MacArthur and the Navy folks on the U.S. side in the Pacific. You've got a lot of British people, Mountbatten in India. And as you mentioned, you've got Chiang Kai-shek in China, but of course he's a native ruler as opposed to somebody coming from Europe or America. So where does China fit into this picture? As you mentioned, it's a war that predates when most Americans think World War II started. So how does China work in relation to the Pacific and the Indian, you know, American and British theaters, if you will?
It's a complicated question. Roosevelt's mind is that we need China to basically hold down the Japanese, and that there we don't need to put ground forces in the China-Burma-India theater. There are plenty there.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked this up the other day. We have 22 Army divisions and 6 Marine divisions that will be fighting across the Pacific. Mm-hmm. So as you said, the Marine divisions are essentially from Guadalcanal are going to move basically north towards Japan. The 22 Army divisions are going to slowly be moved into the fight, going through Australia, then into Papua New Guinea. There's the AmeriCal division that sometimes has the number, the 23rd division called the AmeriCal. It's called the AmeriCal because it was set up in New Caledonia in the South Pacific. We're going to go up through Papua New Guinea into the Philippines, and then the decision had to be made. Do we go straight into Japan, or do we go into Taiwan? On the other side, there's the idea that there will be an offensive eventually in China that will move east. Mm-hmm. So the capital is Nanjing, and that capital gets moved to Chongqing, which is in the center of China, mm-hmm. where it's relatively safe because the Japanese don't have the reach.
Mm-hmm.
So coming up from Burma, you go to Kunming. The capital is at Chongqing. And then from there, you would build up the forces and then begin the Eastern Campaign, which Wedemeyer actually begins in June of 45.
Mm-hmm.
Could it have been done earlier? No. Could we have opened up Burma earlier? To be very honest with you, the Japanese make huge mistakes. The Japanese are so offensive. If they had set up defensive positions in Burma and said, keeping this road closed mm-hmm. is what we need to do.
Like the Germans did in Italy.
Yeah. And keeping the Brits in India. Because the Japanese forces were along the Indian border. Instead of setting up a defense, the Japanese army in Burma went on the offensive in May of 44.
Mm-hmm.
And basically destroyed their own divisions. 3 Japanese divisions are essentially destroyed attacking into Burma, and that allows the rest of Burma to eventually fall. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've got... Chiang Kai-shek at one time had over 500 divisions. What we kept telling him is, that's too many. Just build 90 that are well-trained, well-equipped, well-led. Well, Chiang Kai-shek's biggest problem is... His divisions are a real mix of actual competent military officers who are competently fighting the Japanese and a whole bunch of political hacks. And he needs them all.
Mm-hmm.
He needs good fighting generals, but he also needs... He's scared of fighting generals who build a reputation.
Because then they'll take him on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's problematic. So... Stilwell will build 3 Chinese divisions in Burma,
mm-hmm.
2 of which had escaped to Burma with some other remnants. Chiang Kai-shek basically didn't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. So Stilwell's task list is basically he's got to work with Chiang Kai-shek, who is a very prickly, egotistical, fairly... In parts competent, in parts not.
Let's call him Mercurial.
Mercurial is a good word to use. He also has to build Chinese combat power.
Yep.
And because of the limitations of communications, also spearhead American diplomatic efforts in China with the Nationalist Chinese forces.
Yes. And I don't think the State Department would like you saying the diplomatic piece, because there was always a fine State Department team in China. A lot of them are going to get pilloried during the McCarthy era, but there's a good team. But nevertheless, a military guy working with a military guy is normally better. And Patrick Hurley, Major General, United States Army, Oklahoma National Guard will be sent over by Roosevelt to basically check out what's going on, and he will tell Roosevelt, you need to relieve. And then he takes his uniform off and becomes an ambassador. So there's a military ambassador to China.
So what we're so it's actually complicating further, because he has to do international relations and also work with the United States State Department. So what kind of personality do you need for that, and is Stilwell the right man for this?
No. And Marshall knew Stilwell wasn't the right personality for it. It just, when the U-drum thing fell through, who's the senior guy in the United States Army that understands China? And the fact that he spoke the language and understood China is wonderful. But because he had the wrong personality for it. I mean, he wants to command. Mm-hmm. And so, chief of staff, you don't command. And so, actually, by the time Stilwell has actually got six hats in China, in the China-Burma-India theater. He's number one, chief of staff to Chiang Kai-shek. But he also, when Mountbatten goes to Sri Lanka, Ceylon at the time, and forms Southeast Asia Command, he's the deputy there.
So Lord Mountbatten, for those, is like, he is the senior allied commander, what will become called the China-Burma-India Theater.
Okay, the equivalent today of a combatant commander.
Pretty much that would be the way to look at it. Now, he's a member of the royal family. Mm-hmm. He had planned and got blamed for the failed Dieppe raid. And Churchill was trying to find a place to hide him. And so he hid him out there. Stilwell and he do not get along all that well. Matter of fact, the only Brit that Stilwell gets along with is Slim, General mm-hmm. Slim. And basically, Stilwell says something to the effect, you know, Slim is a Brit I can work with. A limey I can work with, I think is what he actually says. Mm-hmm. So he's got those two jobs. Plus, he's got the training job. We set up a training base in Ramgarh, India. He's basically the commander there. Then there's a combat training command run by Dorn that he is technically in charge of in China. He is the overall commander for the Northern Command, which will be the command that takes back Michina for what everybody mostly knows as the Merrill's Marauders. Mm-hmm. But it's Merrill's Marauders and about six Chinese divisions. Mm-hmm. It's not just Merrill's Marauders that take Michina. And he takes it in May but can't consolidate it till August, which is probably the biggest black mark on Stilwell is. His forces take the area around the airfield at Michina in May. Mm-hmm. But they can't get rid of the Japanese around it so it can be used until August. And he essentially takes the 3,000 men of Merrill's Marauders, and by August there are probably 300 effectives.
90% casualty rate?
90% casualty. And a lot of that's disease, but mm-hmm. he just wears them out. And he doesn't relieve them because he doesn't have any combat forces. So that original thing when U Drum says, how many forces will I have? It's like none. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you before we move off this point. You two are both retired Army officers. What does it tell you about a commander that he has inflicted 90% casualties on a unit in combat, acknowledging tropical disease?
Gary Bjorge, Dr. Gary Bjorge, the China hand here in the department for me, wrote an excellent monograph on it. This is the problem. There are long-range patrols units that the Brits had put together under Ordsey Wingate mm-hmm. that had taken similar amounts of casualties.
These are the Chindits?
The Chindits.
Yeah.
And so, and Slim, in that May 44 offensive. There are British historians who say that the defense of Kohima was the finest hour in British military history. That the units that were fighting up there were just magnificent. Now, there's a British army in India that's not British. Mm-hmm. It's Indian. There are sprinkled in there British units. Most of the primary fighting forces there are Gurkhas, of which Slim, originally from one of the county regiments in Great Britain, becomes a Gurkha officer. And so the Indian units that are there are a broad swipe. Now, the Brits, in their wonderful colonial manner, kind of declared that certain ethnic Indian societies produce better military people. So you've got, you know, Bengal Lancers and the Punjabis and the Sindh, but the Gurkhas were probably at the pinnacle of this. And so it's the Gurkhas that are the primary fighting forces there. But there are West African forces there. It's a polyglot, which is one of the reasons that Stilwell's book, The Defeat into Victory, and how Stilwell as
Slim's.
Slim. Slim's Defeat into Victory, and his explanation of how he kept this force mm-hmm. of it's a global force mm-hmm. Together fighting against the Japanese. So successful defense of India, mm-hmm. Multiple corps. Up in China, there are millions of Chinese fighting over a million Japanese. And Stilwell's commanding 3,000 guys in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So the idea that he had a grasp of the overall strategic picture, and he stayed where he belonged, which would have been in Chongqing beside Chiang Kai-shek, guiding the main effort against the main Japanese forces, is where the new scholarship is headed.
So what you're getting at is that when Drum's question of how many soldiers I will command, you're saying is that Stilwell basically said he came up with the number of 3,000 plus however many Chinese people that I Chinese divisions I can abscond with.
Essentially.
Yeah. And so how would you answer the question, Dr. Nance?
And see, this is, there's a time and a place to take 90% casualties. And that's, and you can argue pluses and minuses, but for me, it's a case of what should you be doing? And this is what where Dr. Babb was, I think, kind of going, is this the time and the place to take 90% casualty, or maybe should I be coming up with a structural way to do this better? Mm-hmm. I always joke, it's like, you should make your plan so that no one has to win a medal in order for it to succeed. Meaning, you know, people win medals when things go bad. When things go really bad, that's when the medals of honor get handed out. Mm-hmm. And as a planner, and the higher up you go, the more you should be planning and coordinating such that things don't get that bad. And so my take on it is that if the guy's supposed to be up at the national level and he is running around with a brigade or a division or a corps-sized force, he's probably doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the 90% casualties in this particular case because it is an important objective that they seize. I'm just asking, could he have arranged forces in a better way to pull that off?
That's where the scholarship is going right now. It's asking and trying to answer that hard question. Mm-hmm. So it's relooking the myth that Chiang Kai-shek wouldn't fight, mm-hmm. the myth that the only Chinese that fought the Japanese were the communists under Mao. That's been taken on, and there was something called the 100 Regiments campaign that happened in, I guess, late 40. Run by Peng Dehuai, who's the general that will fight in Korea, that was an absolute disaster. Mm-hmm. That was essentially the last time the communists fought any kind of a size battle against the Japanese. And they lost badly, and the Japanese retaliated with the Three All campaign. kill all, destroy all, burn all. It was, and maybe a million to a million and a half Chinese died in retaliation for that. So that kind of drove the communists back into their Yan'an, China sanctuary. But Chiang Kai-shek's forces kept fighting all the way through the war.
So this brings up a very interesting point, kind of related to what we've been talking about. We're talking about very high-level decision-makers. We're talking about Chiang Kai-shek, who is a de facto chief of state, if not de jure. We're talking about Mountbatten, who, as you mentioned, is not just a theater commander, he's a member of the royal family. We're talking about people like MacArthur, right, who's a field marshal, in addition to being a U.S. general. And then you've got this American who's commanding essentially a brigade minus with one star, then maybe two stars. So is it perhaps that we have just exaggerated Stilwell's role because he is the American surrounded by Chinese planners? Is it actually the Chinese who are planning things like linking to Burma and cooperating with the other allied powers? Or does Stilwell actually have a role that's outsized from his position and rank?
It's like all of the above. He is everything from the deputy to the leader of the largest nation population-wise on Earth, and he's a brigade commander.
So let's
he's doing it simultaneously, and all of it's not being done well.
Mm-hmm. So why doesn't Marshall step in sooner, and maybe not even relieve him, but if you realize a guy is holding six hats all the way from brigade commander through national level strategy, why doesn't Marshall just send him some more people?
Great question. Bill, you've looked at the flow of general officers in the European theater and how they were being brought up. The expectation, I think, was that they would be brought up from within theater. So Dorn will go from major in 37 to one star. And there are others in there, but they're almost always at the 06 to one star level. We're not getting, because the multi-star generals are in the Chinese army, because the Chinese army is where all the forces are.
Right.
The only U.S. ground forces in theater are Merrill's Marauders. When Merrill's Marauders goes down to the 300, it will be reconstituted as essentially one battalion, the 475th. And the 124th Cavalry, Texas National Guard, will come in, and a new force called the Mars Force will be formed. And it is about a brigade. What Stilwell wants to do is put that in with two Chinese brigades to have a mixed brigade. That really never happens.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it's the timing piece. Once the Burma Road gets open, the first ground convoy will not show up in China until February of 45. So you took Michina in August of 44. That gave you the airfield. It also drove the Japanese south.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think the hump was flown basically south to north. The hump is mostly west to east.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes out of northern India to Kunming. The further you could drive the Japanese Air Force south, the safer it was to a lower altitude route across Burma. So it did make the air and the, I don't have the figures in front of me, but the tonnage going over the hump significantly increased as it became safer to fly over the lower altitudes and the Japanese were no longer able to interdict.
So what you're getting at here is, like, in the European theater and the Mediterranean, well, Mediterranean theater that often sacrificed a lot of folks up to the European theater, both in Europe, one's called European, one's called Mediterranean for reasons that are confusing to this day. But even the Pacific theater, a lot of these guys are kind of getting promoted from within, often from the large amount of ground forces that are present.
Yep.
So is this Stilwell not growing his own, so to speak? Or is this Stilwell not asking for people? Or is this Stilwell asking and not receiving?
In these six different jobs that he had, where he is in charge, he had people that he trusted, and it didn't really matter to him whether they were generals or not. So like Dorn, who's an 05, 06 during most of the time, and then there's some others. But he really overcounted on a very small section of people that he was not producing those people in the numbers that needed to. And one of them is a kind of a strange story, Magruder. Magruder was the first China. He was sent in there to do the Lend-Lease piece. And apparently there were two Magruders in the Army, and Marshall didn't like the other one. And so he wouldn't allow the other Magruder that was in China to be promoted.
Yeah.
So personalities get involved.
This happens to Fred Van Fleet.
Right? Van Fleet, yeah. Very rapidly, once Marshall realizes his mistake, goes from a regimental commander to a corps commander. But on that note there, because in European theater, I spent a lot of time looking at the Eisenhower-Marshall correspondence. There's always, this person needs to be promoted, who's getting promoted, who's going up to Congress, get permanently promoted. Is there that kind of correspondence from Stilwell back to Marshall? Because sometimes you and I have both done the advising job. You need to have it doesn't matter if you're really good at it. You need the right rank to associate at those levels. Is that correspondence going on with Stilwell back to Marshall?
The correspondence that's going back to Marshall is, help me get Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese. He is totally focused on the defeat of the Japanese. And the whole rank thing doesn't seem to make much difference to Stilwell. As a matter of fact, he wanders around looking like an Army private anyway. I mean, when you see the pictures of Stilwell, he's either all dressed up, standing next to Chiang Kai-shek, or he is sitting in the field somewhere with a M1 carbine on his lap, about ready for another long walk across Burma. He's a unique personality.
How does that play to the soldiers, and you guys, again, both veterans?
Well, the strange thing is, at Ramgar, he brings over, I'm going to say, 250 soldiers from Fort Benning to be the trainers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I remember right, they leave Savannah, and 45 days later, they show up in Karachi, Pakistan, to then move overland diagonally across India to Ramgarh, which is up in Bihar. It's 60 days to get from Benning. You know, we do it now in 24 hours by plane, so the timing of this is all. But those guys that were there, they will actually train Chinese generals, and the Chinese generals will appreciate the training they're getting from these guys. So the soldiers at Ramgar that were training the Chinese and would later filter out into the force as advisors, they liked him. I mean, Vinegar Joe went with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was on the long march. He wasn't catching a plane ride back. He was with them. He was a fighting general, and they're generally appreciated. Now, the 300 that are left and the others that were before, they were awarded a presidential unit citation for that. So when we're talking about, you know, if somebody needs a medal, they're probably doing too much work. Well, presidential unit citation is the highest unit citation you can get. They earned it. So this idea that he is a brigade commander in a theater commander's world.
Mm-hmm.
Is certainly out there. He would probably argue, if he was here, after he probably took a few swings at me, would be that was the decisive point. Once we took Michina, we would be driving the Japanese south, we'd open up the road,
mm-hmm.
and again, it's one of the things about World War II that I keep thinking about all the time. Nobody thought we were going to win this thing till 1949. Mm-hmm. This is 1944. There's 5 years left in the war if you're a planner.
Mm-hmm.
So what he's doing in Michita compared to what's going to happen, we're not going to see the Russians in the war. This is another thing. The Soviets are not in the war in the Far East. In 41, I think 2 months before Barbarossa, the Japanese and the Soviets signed a non-aggression pact.
Mm-hmm. After the Japanese and Soviets fought a couple battles.
Falcon Goal, Nomonon, the Soviets kind of
wiped the floor with the Japanese.
Yes.
That's a nice way of saying it. And at the end of the day, both sides knew that the Russians, you know, looking at the potential of what was going on in Europe, what they had to do, they didn't need to go all the way across their country to the Far East, and the Japanese were going to have enough troubles if they went against us. So the Russians are not in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And now you get into the question that Dr. Nance asked earlier. What's the strategic piece? Well, it's not the strategic military piece that really consumes Stillwell early on. It's that strategic piece that he's been told, turn China into a fighting army that can defeat the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, there's a whole project that we will be bombing Japan from China. So we are building hundreds of runways in mm-hmm. China. And that's that Matterhorn project is to bring the B-29s into China to be able to bomb the whole home islands of Japan. Mm-hmm. Since we don't know how fast we're going to get across the Pacific, the place to bomb Japan from is, but you got to control it. Right. To control it. And this is where Stillwell has the biggest fight with the other great hero of the theater, Claire Chennault.
Mm-hmm. Who's the air commander, right?
Yeah. Captain Chennault retires from the United States Air Force. And then he becomes essentially a contractor. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he is the personal contractor for Mrs. Chiang Kai-shek. And he is in the air over Shanghai when the Japanese attack Shanghai in 37. The Japanese destroy the Chinese Air Force. It is an Air Force that is a disaster from day one. You know, we go through a pretty rigorous program to pick pilots. We want them to be physically fit with eyes like hawks to...
Mm-hmm.
No. The Chinese Air Force, they all were looking at pilots from World War I wearing their scarves and being, you know... So... the people that were chose to be pilots in the Chinese Army in the 30s, Chinese Air Force in the 30s, the CAF, were essentially the rich kids.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them were not physically fit or ready. And so it becomes a disaster. So eventually Chennault will end up out in Chongqing and Kunming rebuilding the Chinese Air Force with U.S. planes. The problem is the U.S. planes are going to Europe. And so the P-40s of the Flying Tigers are the leftovers that the Brits don't want.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how they're available.
So Stillwell's feuding with Chennault for resources.
All the time. So what comes over the hump, Chennault wants to be to support the air campaign. What Chiang Kai-shek wants is what Chennault wants. That adds to the problem.
So the one of the things we talk about often in our course here is people focusing at the tactical level and assuming you can win victory there and it will go up to the strategic level. Is that what Stillwell is doing here, or does he genuinely have a strategic view of the theater?
I think he shares the strategic view of the theater in that the defeat of the Japanese,
mm-hmm.
given that the Pacific Theater is the second theater and the CBI is a close fourth, in terms of U.S. assets, and mm-hmm. It's either the Chinese do it or it doesn't get done.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, he is strategically focused on getting Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese. And I believe he is absolutely convinced you have to have your line of communication fixed. They'd lost the line of communication in Vietnam when the Vichy French turned it over. They'd lost Hong Kong when the when the Japanese took Hong Kong in December of 1941. So there's only one way to go, and that's through Burma.
But so the question is, since Stillwell is up at these levels, he's got six hats. One of the things we teach people is, if you've got six hats, delegate, right?
Yeah.
So it seems to me that why, if he has national level responsibilities that he can't delegate, why doesn't he delegate the Machinka mission? I'm probably saying that incorrectly. Why doesn't he delegate the Michina operation to a colonel that he can then promote to brigadier and let that guy run that fight, and he stays at the and he stays where he should be?
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, Bill, because he does. Merrill's Marauders shouldn't have been Merrill's Marauders. They should have been Hunter's Marauders. Colonel Hunter is the guy that trained and put together. But Stillwell, in a unnice way of saying it, had his sycophants. Mm-hmm. And Stillwell overdid the loyalty to the people that were loyal to him. So he's got a guy named Merrill, mm-hmm. I think, who's already had two heart attacks and had been medevaced at least twice, and it may have been more. But he's the guy that Stillwell trusts to take Michina, but it doesn't work. And so, like a lot of American Army officers, he's impatient, and I have to go do it myself. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't know Hunter all that well, and when Merrill's not able because of his heart attacks, Stillwell just goes and does it himself. And again, I think Stillwell would argue that was the decisive point at the time for the operational need to open the line of communication. And so, he wasn't the chateau general.
Yeah. He
wasn't going to sit in Chongqing, one, because he didn't want to be anywhere near Chiang Kai-shek. He just hated him. And the feeling was mutual. There's a set of correspondence that goes through Hurley back to Roosevelt that Chiang Kai-shek says, you must relieve him. He's not competent. Mm-hmm. Chiang Kai-shek is telling Roosevelt that Stillwell's not competent. All you have to do is look at what he's doing down in Burma. He couldn't take this even one small town.
Mm-hmm. So he is relieved, as you mentioned, by Wedemeyer, and he goes to the Pacific to command.
He goes to Okinawa.
So how does he do there?
The battle for Okinawa is over by the time he gets there. Yeah. That's the general story. So he's there for the mop-up cleanup. Mm-hmm. And then the war's over.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, that initial idea that Stillwell should have been the commander in North Africa, what would North Africa had looked like if he, instead of Friedendahl, had been in North Africa? Mm-hmm. Because he was certainly set up for it.
Mm-hmm.
He'd commanded his brigade, commanded his division, commanded his corps in the first year and a half getting ready. He was very well known. But as that book, Army at Dawn, by Rick Atkinson indicates, I'm not sure anybody could have commanded the United States Army in North Africa and done very well. Just look, Patton mm-hmm. and what, Second Armor?
Well, it's funny. It's like Patton commanded the Western Task Force going into Morocco. But yeah, it's like if Patton is in place of Friedendahl, I don't think that it is as bad. But after a certain point, being first in the chute's always hard, right?
Well, this is the stop.
If Stillwell had been Patton's commander,
yeah,
and had done better than Friedendahl, then it wouldn't have been Patton going into Sicily or Bradley and Patton. There's no, now a three-way fight for command.
This is where we laugh nervously and ask what happens when if you put Stillwell and Patton in the same room, what happens?
Yeah. Yeah, so, and this is the soft thesis, right? America always loses its first battles. So, by way of conclusion, you've talked a little bit about kind of the historiographical camps with regard to Stillwell. One, kind of him as the tent pole, we center him, we say he's the important American, and then the newer historiography, which is arguing that he's not actually as important as we've made him. So where do you fall in that, based on the understanding of this conflict?
I believe that what we did was, with Barbara Tuchman's book, Stillwell and the American Experience in China, which is hagiography of Stillwell, that needed to be relooked. And there were what's very interesting is John King Fairbank and his wife, John King Fairbank being the China scholar at Harvard and probably, you know, the leading China scholar of his day. There were people that were writing him, and there's like a 60-page critique of Tuchman's book of all of the errors that she makes when she writes that book. So that was out there. And then the counter to that is Forgotten Ally by Rana Mitter, which looks the other way. In the middle of that, it's a book that I didn't bring in. It is essentially, we have the Stillwell papers. We now have the Chiang Kai-shek diaries. And Jeff Taylor wrote that. And that started the hagiography. That now says, no, Chiang Kai-shek is really this much maligned, you know, really a great strategist, Tom Homa, and Stillwell is just terrible. I think it will have to swing. It gets back to my view of Chiang Kai-shek has changed significantly over time. Walk a mile in his shoes. And I think the same thing is with Stillwell, that when you walk a mile in his shoes and you understand what Roosevelt and Marshall expected of him, and then how he saw it not happening at a speed of an American. The impatient American versus the patient Chinese.
And it's worth pointing out, you guys keep harping on him wearing six hats, right? That's not his fault. It's his superior's fault.
Which leads us to perhaps a great kind of big question, which is, what kind of personality do you need for somebody thrust into this situation where they have to handle tactical, operational, and strategic, as well as diplomatic? You could say grand strategic. There's a couple different things. What kind of person do you need there?
I think you need the person the United States Army cannot make.
How so?
We either seem to have the strategic diplomat or the competent tactical commander trying to find that happy medium. Maybe it was Ridgway. But then, you know, Ridgway in Korea, not Ridgway with 18th Airborne Corps at the Battle of the Bulge, Ridgway in Korea, and then not Ridgway pounding on Eisenhower's head. So they don't exist. They're hard to build.
Well, and it's fair to point out, if you have six hats, maybe you need six people.
You know, maybe it's like saying, you know, since this guy is a great rodeo personage, let's put him in a Indy 500 car, because they got to be the same talent.
Horse and a car, the same thing.
Or Michael Jordan, one of the finest basketball players in history. But when he went down to play baseball in Birmingham, it wasn't so good.
Yeah, 200 average, right? Yeah, no, that's a good analogy. Dr. Babb, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
My pleasure.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.